on Big Ideas on RN tonight. We're at the State Library of New South Wales for two talks presented at a History Week symposium titled Peace and Patriotism in 20th Century Australia. 100 years ago, many Australian men valiantly went to fight in the Great War. They went for king and country, for travel and adventure, but there are also many, for very good and different reasons, who chose not to go. To shed some light on why men did or didn't choose to go to the war and their attitudes towards service, duty and expectation, our next speaker is Bart Zeno, lecturer in history at Deakin University.
Today I want to examine some of the conflicting attitudes that individual Australian men expressed towards volunteering, enlisting during the First World War. Today, you know, if we look back on it, what we can see is, I guess, over the course of the war, the insistence that it was a man's duty to serve in the military became louder and more insistent. Recruiting posters, praise of volunteers by politicians, even the giving of white feathers, though I think we overstate just how much this actually happened. All of this suggests to us the weight of expectation in public that men should go to the front. And yet, in private, that sentiment was contested by a determination that men had duties in the home that had to be weighed against the demands of war. Through an examination of men's private correspondence and their responses to some official questioning, I want to show not only two conceptions of male duty in conflict, but I want to show the intense negotiation, calculation and bargaining that that conflict incited amongst men and their families. This is important, I think, because it highlights one of the key things that we really need to understand about the Great War in Australia, and that is that the responsibility for deciding what could be given, how much could be sacrificed to the war and what could not be sacrificed to the war, remains for the duration of the war with individuals and their families rather than with government. It's a situation that produced terrible social division in Australia as each person weighed their duty to the nation at war against the responsibility that they saw in others. And the government never steps in, I guess, to mediate and decide on that. It can't, in fact, do that. The first point then to be made about enlistment, except for a very few men who had no ties at all, is that that decision was always a negotiation between the demands of the war and responsibilities to family, whether as a son or a husband or a father. From the very start of the war, the great bulk of men were well aware of the tensions occasioned within families by the prospect of their potential enlistment. In 1914 in Tasmania, Cathy Smith pleaded with her husband not to be drawn into the war. She feared she'd lose him. She said this, "Oh, laddie, don't volunteer, if it's at all possible to get out of it. It makes me feel quite sick when I think of you going away." Confronted with that decision soon after, her husband acquiesced. "I nearly did, but I didn't." In fact, he goes away following May. Those kinds of invocations to remain, of course, are not always effective. Only a week after the outbreak of war, Alfred Adams told his mother, "Your letter came too late. I have already volunteered to go to Europe." We might imagine what exactly she wrote in that letter. Despite his response, what Alfred Adams also showed us, though, was that men's decisions were underpinned by rationalisations that freed them from the claims of family. As he put it, "If I do get shot, you have the other boys and you would not miss me so much as any of my other brothers, as I'm always away." So even in the earliest days of the war, men don't enlist without reference to their interests and their family responsibilities at home. Indeed, before the landing at Gallipoli and the mass casualties that came with it, the kinds of self-interested calculations that men and their families might make were acknowledged and largely accepted. So Cam Suchard in Melbourne felt rather mean at staying at home, as he put it, but he and his father came to the conclusion that enlistment would set him back in his career and therefore he remained at home without any of the social problems that might attend to that later in the war. Events at Gallipoli, though, in April and May 1915, along with the deteriorating circumstances of the Allied war effort in the middle of that year, changed public attitudes towards a man's duty. And for many men, it changed private attitudes too, especially middle-class men. The result is a major shift in the relative obligations between the war and home. As first news of the Gallipoli landing filtered through, the university student Malcolm Stirling wrote to his mother this: "The war, instead of getting better, is getting blacker every day, and I think it is the duty of every responsible person to do his share." What had kept him back, Stirling said, was the feeling that I have a duty to you and Dad. I still think I have. Now that things are getting so serious, I think every family should make a sacrifice. And he went on to rationalise this by saying, my brother's got a full-time job, I don't have one yet, you can spare me. So such young men were struggling with their own conscience as much as with those public encouragements to enlist that were being made more frequently now in public. When Melbourne man David Moore decided to enlist in mid-May 1915, he insisted, "It is certainly very hard on the poor martyr, but I'm afraid the matter is out of my hands now and it must be considered a duty." From the middle of 1915 then, and especially with the advent of those major recruiting campaigns, public representations of an idealised military manhood, and indeed non-manhood, became much more pronounced and much more direct. So you get these kind of recruiting posters. Later on in the war you get that... When I talk about non-manhood, I'm talking about these representations of shirkers. Such images as these surely had their effect. In Kyneton, in Victoria, Don Armstrong had determined that he would enlist. He told his father that apart from the time being right, this is what he said, "Another reason is that I think it is the greatest opportunity for a chap to make a man of himself. Those that come back from this war will be men of the right sort that anybody would be proud of." Nevertheless, most men, even when deciding that they would go, that they would enlist, still continued to judge their responsibilities and rationalise their decisions in terms of traditional male obligations to family. Wives and parents, too, continued to express reservations about their men enlisting. Despite his own feelings, Oscar Berendt's mother refused to allow her son to enlist, given his position in the family. He said, "She says that as I am the principal wage earner of the family, I have no right to endanger my life in any way. Even where families might consent to someone going away, the difficulties of men's decisions were hardly reduced." Writing after he had enlisted, Roy Mulvey told his wife, "I almost regret the step I have taken. The conflicting duties with which I am confronted are difficult to reconcile." So that problem doesn't really let up even after men might make the decision to go away. By the end of 1915, public pressures to enlist had escalated again. Some buckled to those pressures. Ern Randall told his father in October 1915 that he had to enlist, "as I could not be what people consider one of these shirkers any longer." Despite that, though, at the end of 1915, there comes a very powerful expression of the legitimacy of the male as a breadwinner. And this came when the government commenced actively to question military-age men about their enlistment intentions. They sent this form to almost a million young men in Australia, or, well, military-age men, asking specifically whether they would enlist for the war, and if they wouldn't, why they wouldn't do that. It's a wonderful resource for us now. The overwhelming majority of people responding were negative. But that wasn't just resistance. It was the weighing of two competing forms of duty against each other. Fathers with children found it easiest to declare that their priorities lay at home, though single men with aged parents to consider equally claimed that they had familial responsibilities. 32-year-old John Rosser of Newport in Victoria insisted that he was not going to enlist, as he said, "I consider my duty clear, to stay here and keep my wife and children." Now, that conception of duty to family didn't have many public outlets when you contrast it with the efforts that were being made to encourage men to take on military responsibilities. But in private, what we see is that duty to family was a very powerful and very legitimate lever against volunteering for military service. The contest then between those two conceptions of a man's duty were not, and we've already seen this, are not easy to reconcile for all men. 40-year-old John Beecroft, a rural Bagshot in Victoria, would not enlist, but his response to this questioning allows us to see that contest between conceptions of appropriate masculine behaviour were not easy to resolve one way or the other. He said, "I cannot convince myself that it is my duty to enlist yet and neglect my wife and family." So he doesn't necessarily mean here that the war hasn't got bad enough yet. What he's suggesting here is that there are others who have lesser duties than himself who should go first. And this is the kind of thing that is going on amongst these men, and we'll see in a moment what the result is. But to give you a sense of this, we have a man called Frank Roberts of Middle Park in Melbourne who says that when all single men with no dependents have gone and men are still wanted, then I think it will be my duty to go, not before. So there's an assessment here of one's responsibilities against those that one sees in others. The result is a deep paralysis in recruiting. It stops men who might go from volunteering themselves, even where they might judge themselves to have similar levels of responsibility to other men. They refuse to enlist lest they give up opportunities that they are developing in civil life, which other men might then cash in on, I guess, for want of a better term. As George Jones put it, he's a 23-year-old labourer at the Rushworth Eucalyptus Factory. He said this: "I am just waiting for hundreds of men, which is like myself." He didn't have parents to look after. He didn't have a wife or children, but he said, "I'm not going while other people of the same standing aren't going either." What produced that situation? It was the question of duty being left to the individual to judge. We might understand then that there were those people, men of military age, who looked to conscription positively to break that cycle of self-examination. The prospect of conscription, which had been gathering pace since mid-1915, offered some men relief from their attempts to reconcile their divided sense of duty. So here in Sydney, L.J. Simonson positively welcomed the idea that conscription might come as a way of taking, as he said, the responsibility off my shoulders. "It is really very hard," he wrote, "for persons so placed to decide which has the first call on him, or rather if he will serve his country best by going to fight and perhaps not return, or to return to be a burden to his country, or to stay at home and support those dependent on him." Charles Davies of Rochester West simply stated that conscription alone will assign us our posts. Volunteerism leaves many in doubt where duty lies. Though men declared that under conscription they would be willing to go in their turn, they were still assessing their level of responsibility relative to other men. So when people say this sort of stuff, what they mean is, "I'll go in my turn, but my turn's not yet." And so Frederick Robinson, who says, "You know, I've got financial troubles that prevent me from going," demanded conscription nevertheless, but placed himself low in that order of who ought to go. Conscription, he wrote, was the only fair way, as it is unfair to ask us to throw up everything and fight for shirkers who will not work or do anything for the country except drink and hang out around the street corners. All right, so there are the men who ought to go before I go. When Prime Minister Hughes then announced that he indeed intended to introduce conscription, subject to the vote of the people, the contest over duty that was being conducted in private now explodes into public. The first conscription campaign in September and October 1916 not only offered opportunities for accusations of shirking to be made in public, you point to people and say that they were shirkers, it also exposed too just how acute a problem the judging of one's own responsibilities and duties had become. In working class communities especially, the rising cost of living and decreasing real wages help to increase those anxieties about the effects that conscription would have on their families. So the conscription campaign was marked, at least in part, by an insistence on the continued validity of the male breadwinner remaining behind. Both sides of the conscription debate mobilised images of fathers who might be obliged to leave their families. On one hand, anti-conscriptionists claimed that married men would soon be required. This had happened in England. They weren't supposed to be taken at first, and very quickly they were conscripted. On the other hand, pro-conscriptionists argued that married men, if there were no conscription, married men would succumb to the call of patriotism while shirkers held back, and so families again would lose their breadwinners. Of course, the conscription campaign is lost twice, and in the bitter aftermath of that failure, private motives remain more than ever public property. And no one was more open to this charge, I would suggest, than the 21-year-old boxer Les Darcy. Les Darcy was criticised publicly and privately for not enlisting in the war, given that he represented the kind of Australian man those recruiting posters were talking about directly. You notice that the picture had "give up your sporting equipment for the gun." And so when Les Darcy in 1917 leaves the country illegally to fight in the United States, of course, he's subject to an extraordinary amount of criticism. The other thing to add to that, then, is that he died shortly after in the United States. Nevertheless, Darcy, too, had articulated his own struggle to reconcile his sense of duty and where it lay. In a letter to his promoter after he left, he explained that he fully intended to enlist for the war once his fight commitments were completed in the United States. And this is what he said. "I have, as you know, right now, a chance of settling my family on their feet for the rest of their lives." Sorry, there's Les Darcy. "And I can do it in a short time. Then I don't care what becomes of me. I'll go to the front, but I think I would be a bigger cur if I went to the front and left a starving family behind." Now, thousands of people went to see Darcy's funeral in Maitland in New South Wales, but the animosities died hard. The soldier Oliver Coleman, writing from France, having a family member tell him about this funeral, wrote back, "I could understand it had he been a fighter instead of a cold footer." Now, Darcy was, I think, less unique than he was representative of the struggle that continued amongst men to define their male duty. They did not make that decision to remain just once. They had to keep making that decision as the war continued, and they weighed their obligations constantly. In the latter part of the war, the official war correspondent Henry Gullett observed, as he was heading off on a troop ship, "men who," he said, "had come up soberly and thoughtfully, and with most of them the delay has been due not to any slacking, but to responsibilities which could not be sooner put aside." Observers of recruits later in the war, in fact much later in the war, noticed that people that were coming forward in 1918 were either largely young men under 20 or middle-aged men who had now determined that their duty to home had been overcome by their sense of duty to serve at the front. So the dynamic between those two forms of masculinity was still shifting late in the war, though perhaps very slowly. In 1918, 38-year-old Stanley Skipper now saw in his child not a reason for remaining, but a compulsion to go. He imagined his child saying, "Bill Jones' father's a soldier, so when are you going away?" Don't know that any child ever said that to their parent. The question of a man's duty then during the First World War was a profoundly difficult one. The simple point, I suppose, to make is that the legitimacy of privileging one's duties to families over demands for enlistment has been obscured for us, not only by recruiting propaganda, but by that intensive post-war effort to enshrine the Anzac soldier as the paragon of civic virtue. It's harder for us to see the private calculations and demands that encourage men to remain and to feel justified in doing so. The bigger issue, I think, to address is how this question of duty shaped Australians' experiences of the First World War. Unlike almost all other belligerents in Australia, that determination of what to give and how much to give, as I said, remained with individuals and families of whom I've been speaking. Investigating how they responded to that burden has the potential to tell us much about how a people not only faced but helped to make the first of the 20th century's total wars. Thank you.
Bart Zeno, historian from Deakin University on Australian men and meanings of duty in the Great War. On Big Ideas here on RN, let's head back to the State Library of New South Wales for highlights of the Q&A session.
It strikes me that in some way, that was really great paper and really interesting. And I thought that question of the breadwinner makes total sense when you think about Harvester Judgment, which is just a few years earlier. And it also struck me, as I quickly looked it up, that the widow's pension is not introduced in Australia until 1940s. And I was wondering why the state didn't kind of think about ways to acknowledge the breadwinner obligation and the way that that's enshrined in the whole sort of wages system and kind of social welfare systems in Australia. Breadwinners would have wanted to know who's going to look after my family in my absence. But it strikes me that that's a really obvious, it would have been a way to have alleviated that concern that many men had.
You're right. And the approach from the authorities was that recruiters only needed to point out to prospective recruits what the entitlements of a soldier were and what, you know, might get put aside for a family, what the terrible word death benefit could be. The problem that they've got is, you know, today we talk about the six bob a day tourist and make it sound good, but of course six bob is nowhere near what a, you know, even a semi-skilled person could make in Australia. So what we find is lots of people sat down at the kitchen table, worked it out and said, well, that doesn't work. And so, but that's the limit of government provisioning for families. So they do say, you know, especially late in the war, you know, they send out instructions to recruiters and they say, point this out to them. But it doesn't work. Yeah, so that's, you know, there's no real effort here to make some kind of parity between being a soldier and looking after your family. And, of course, the other end of that equation is men know that they actually do play a part in family life. You know, they know that money in the bank doesn't count when they can't sit at home and talk to their kids.
Just a quick point of clarification and a question. Pensions were available for war widows during as the war went on.
Yeah.
So it's not like they weren't available until 1940.
Sure.
So just clarifying that. And the question is, the fact that the two conscription referenda were lost means that in the end the people spoke in the sense that they didn't believe the state did have a higher claim on the duty of men than did their families. And I wondered, have you found any evidence in the letters of the failure of the conscription referenda leading to a greater sense of justification about that decision, or have any, that public narrative having any impact on the kind of ways people are talking about it?
Just one. Bob Menzies, I found. Strangely enough, a letter that referred to, from another person that said they'd approached this young upstart who's now working in a law firm for saying, why aren't you going to the war? And Menzies' response was, I didn't believe we have conscription in this country. Strangely enough thing for him to say, given that he stood up on the stump and advocated it. Though I don't find that so much, and I guess, 51% voted against it and 49% for it. So, I mean, the question's resolved in one way, but the problem persists for families. So I would suspect that the conscription issue is much more a relief for people that, you know, might have found themselves in this situation than a justification to parade in public. But I guess it reinforces the point that you're not the only one who has to make this decision, and you're not the only one who's justifying it in that way.
I wondered if you situated this in the historiography now, saying that there wasn't this great mass enthusiasm for war that's driving it all forward. Saying there wasn't. And this was something that politicians said later on, that they'd been driven forward by mass enthusiasm.
Yeah, certainly it's a very positive story for those who later on spoke about why the war had been meaningful, and they talked about the unity that had been there at the start of the war. And more and more we look at that and we say, well, there really isn't a great, you know, an enormous amount of unity. Some of it's papered over. So I guess I'd start from the point that I made earlier, that right from the beginning of the war, there's no releasing of the shackles and saying, off you go, boys, this is fine, the empire's in danger, and you go. There's bargaining all the way along. Now, that would tend to reinforce your point that, you know, there is no great wave of enthusiasm. I mean, really, for us in Australia, it's May 1915 when that question is asked much more seriously about whether one... what it is that we need to give to this war. So if we wanted to talk about levels of commitment, then we'd probably have to point much more squarely at that. I would suggest, however, that the other side of the coin to that argument that there's no great amount of enthusiasm for the war is that you do have to ask why it is that we remain sending people to this war for 4.5 years, and they're terrible. And you do have to accept that there is a level of commitment to this war in Australia and in all the belligerent societies that makes it happen. Right? There's no... I mean, we might have got close, had the war kept going, to people standing up in the streets and saying, enough, but we certainly remain behind it long enough for it to go on to the conclusion that we wanted. So we do have to be careful on that front. We do have to talk about commitment and the level of commitment that Australians had.
Bart Zeno, lecturer in history at Deakin University. You've been listening to highlights of two sessions recorded at Peace and Patriotism in 20th Century Australia, a symposium presented by the History Council of New South Wales, the Faculty of Arts at Macquarie University, and the State Library of New South Wales for this year's History Week. And that's it for Big Ideas for tonight. Thanks for listening. Join me again tomorrow night. I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.